This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Terror State Targets Lynn Stewart, Part 4, The Relentless Assault on Democratic Rights. We start today by dedicating this show to longtime WBAI programmer Alumbe Brath, and also longtime friend of ours, Ralph.
Alumbe, celebrating his 70th birthday in a celebration that has engulfed and brought to a party and an honoring of all of the major figures involved in struggle in the greater New York area. Alumbe of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition, Alumbe Brath of the weekly forums at the Harriet Tubman School, Alumbe Brath, comrade of Malcolm X, Alumbe who actually authored the one-act play about Malcolm and the Conch that Spike Lee paid the highest tribute by swiping as his own for his film about Malcolm, Alumbe who's been a fixture of every mobilization, every meeting, every struggle for African-American rights, for the liberation of the oppressed, and the struggle for the emancipation of Africa from imperial dominion. This is your show, Alumbe. This is our struggle as it has been for 45 years, brother. Happy birthday.
Today on Taking Aim, the relentless assault on democratic rights. Let's look at recent actions by the U.S. Congress. On September 28th, legislation adopted by the House of Representatives on the Wednesday before and the Senate on Thursday, September 28th, legalized the Bush administration's policy of torture and indefinite detention without trial. It legalized kangaroo court procedures for Guantanamo detainees. It marked, according to the press, a watershed for the United States, a new point in American history when Congress and the White House agreed to set aside provisions of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and formally adopt methods traditionally identified with police states. The New York Times, in a seminal editorial, stated, "Congress passed a tyrannical law that will be ranked with the low points in American democracy, our generation's version of the Alien and Sedition Acts." This was the New York Times editorial on September 28th, entitled, "Rushing Off a Cliff." Then, let's go back in history. Let's go way back in history, but only as far as the time of the Second World War. The Enabling Act in Germany was passed by Germany's parliament, the Reichstag, comparable to the U.S. Congress, and it was passed on March 23, 1933. It was the second major step after the Reichstag fire decree, through which the Nazi Party obtained dictatorial powers, using largely legal means. The act, the Enabling Act, enabled Chancellor Adolf Hitler, who was elected in regular German democratic elections, and his cabinet to enact laws without the participation of the Reichstag, that is, without the participation of the parliament comparable to our Congress. The formal name of the Enabling Act, translated into English, is the Law to Remedy the Distress of the People and the Reich. Joseph Goebbels wrote shortly after the passage of the Enabling Act, quote, "The authority of the Führer has now been wholly established. Votes are no longer taken. The Führer decides. All this is going much faster than we dared to hope." The Enabling Act, 1933. The Military Commissions Act of 2006 here in the United States, putting into law what President George Bush, had said only recently, quote, "I'm the decider, and I decide what's best." Ralph?
The Enabling Act that ended the Weimar Republic, to all intents and purposes, was preceded by a series of predations upon democratic rights. Not only did the Weimar Republic capitulate before the constant demands to retreat from protections for dissent, but in the streets, the thugs and the gangs began to mobilize. Financed by capital, they were determined to prevent working people and the population at large from resisting. We have to bear in mind that 6 million Social Democratic voters and 7 million Communist Party voters, 13 million voters, could be mobilized in the struggle against fascism in Germany. But they were divided by the capitulation of the Social Democrats, and they were divided by the fact that under Stalin's direction at the time, the Communist Party decided that the Social Democracy was worse than Hitler. But within that framework of collaboration by the two major parties of working people that had the capacity to mobilize a resistance in the streets and to challenge the authority of the ruling class for the power that was quickly moving towards dictatorial methods, there was no such struggle by the parties in question. And today, as Bush the Decider declares that he alone has the authority to decide, the dismantling of democratic gains transcends the struggles of that 18th century revolution in the United States. What we are witnessing here is the elimination of gains that go back to the 12th century when Henry II ruled in Great Britain, when the first beginnings of what came to be known as habeas corpus were being put into motion. It goes back to the Magna Carta when the incorporation of the right to challenge the arbitrary authority of the king in his absolutism was encoded into law. Under the terms of the law that's being adopted now, the president can designate any person as an unlawful enemy combatant to be rounded up by intelligence agents, to be jailed indefinitely without legal recourse. And the law defines, that has just been passed by both parties, an unlawful enemy combatant as an individual engaged in hostilities against the United States. And what is the view of this Bush administration and the Democratic Party that supports it as to what constitutes hostilities? The definition has erased any legal distinction between an immigrant who makes a charitable donation to Lebanese Relief and an American college student who clashes with police during a protest demonstration against the war. No longer is there a distinction to be made between those who oppose the policies of the Imperium, those who resist the dictatorial powers that are being imposed, those who identified with the oppressed who are the targets across the world of this imperial reign. I want to remind our listeners, brothers and sisters, that at the time of the war in Vietnam, we, at the time in the Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation, sent a letter to the New York Times in which we identified the gases that explode the pupil of the eye, the chemicals and the biological and the bacteriological agents that were being imposed upon the people of Vietnam, the saturation bombing that included phosphorus, white phosphorus, and cluster bombs and napalm, the declaration that anything that moves was a target throughout Indochina. And we went to Indochina, and we formed the War Crimes Tribunal. And we went into the liberated zones of the south of Vietnam. And we went on the radio of the National Liberation Front. And we broadcast an appeal to American soldiers, an appeal to recognize that they were being used and abused, that the systematic electrical torture that was being inflicted on all that who were detained, that the torment of villages who were being massacred, not just in the My Lai that we came to know about years later, but week in and week out, month in and month out, were crimes, crimes against humanity, crimes for which everybody who participated in them would be responsible, that the soldiers had a responsibility, backed by the population in the United States, to resist those orders, to come forward with the truth about what was being done in Vietnam. And that was the basis of the testimony of soldiers from every part of the U.S. Army in Stockholm, in New York, in London, in Japan, in Paris. The War Crimes Tribunal documented the crimes of American imperialism and engaged U.S. soldiers in the resistance to that struggle. That right would land us in a detention camp today, brothers and sisters. That practice would qualify us to be rounded up without habeas corpus, without right of counsel, without notification of family, well, without even the legal right to protest or make known that we or those close to us had been taken. Those are the stakes. That's what this Lynn Stewart persecution is fundamentally about, the destruction of every right for which we've struggled for hundreds of years.
Ralph, let's look at the specifics of the recent Military Commissions Act of 2006, and we should note its overwhelming passage. The fact that even Democrats who are considered liberal Democrats, but who are up for election, voted for this heinous new law. The New York Times editorial lists various sections of the new Military Commissions Act and the problems, the deeper, the biggest, what they call the bill's biggest flaws. Enemy combatants, the dangerously broad definition of illegal enemy combatant in the bill would subject legal residents of the United States as well as foreign citizens living in their own countries or as residents here in the United States to summary arrest and indefinite detention with no hope of appeal. The president could give the power to apply this label to anyone he wants. And the reason they say that is because the president has the authority to assign to the Secretary of Defense and to pick a hand-picked small commission, it doesn't say of what size, that will determine who the illegal enemy combatants are. The term is illegal enemy combatants because a legal enemy combatant, according to law, are enemy combatants of states who are in so-called hostilities against the United States. The Geneva Conventions would be repudiated, the half century of international precedent, by allowing the president to decide on his own what is the standard of abusive interrogation methods that he considers permissible. And there's no requirement, the Times notes, that the list be published. In other words, it's up in the air what is considered to be torture. Habeas corpus, as you mentioned. Detainees in U.S. military prisons lose the basic right to challenge their imprisonment, and we will discuss later what habeas corpus actually means. It is the right to challenge your detention. In other words, to go before a judge and have the prosecution state explicitly why you are being held. Habeas corpus is an important right. It goes back to the 12th century and in 1649 was encoded in British law. Judicial review. The courts would have no power to review any aspect of the new system except for specific verdicts of the military tribunals, and these would be reviewed by the appellate court in the District of Columbia. The bill limits these appeals, and it bars legal actions based on the Geneva Conventions, directly or indirectly. Coerced evidence. Very important. The Military Commissions Act of 2006 codifies the torture of the Guantanamo detainees and those who were subjected to CIA renditions to foreign countries. It codifies all this torture of these detainees prior to the passage of the 2005 Detainee Treatment Act. Secret evidence. American Standards of Justice, the Times notes, prohibits evidence and testimony that is kept secret from the defendant, whether the accused is a corporate executive or a mass murderer. This, the Times states specifically. But the bill weakens the protections against such evidence. It states explicitly that if the government considers evidence as classified, as secret, this can be barred from the detainee. Offenses. The definition of torture is unacceptably narrow. A virtual reprise, the Times notes, of the deeply cynical memos the administration produced after 9/11. Memos that were crafted by now Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and now law professor at UC Berkeley, John Yoo, who at the time was working for the administration. Rape and sexual assault are defined in a way that covers only forced or coerced activity. The bill effectively eliminates the idea of rape as torture. These are just some of the elements that are mentioned in this important editorial in the New York Times, Rushing Off a Cliff. Ralph.
Keep in mind the following. One or two members of Congress attempted to impose or to put forward amendments to modify slightly this draconian bill that now authorizes torture, that authorizes arbitrary detention, that exonerates it or exempts the administration from any accountability. The amendments were defeated by an alliance of the two parties. One of the amendments would have granted habeas corpus rights for prisoners. That is to say, that the prisoner had the right through the habeas corpus demand, produce the body, to be actually presented with evidence against him or her. The prisoner would have the right to ask for a public demonstration of evidence that had to be proved. That was defeated. That was massively defeated. In fact, a further amendment that sought oversight over the torture program that had been sanctioned for the Central Intelligence Agency, that oversight was defeated. The restriction on the use of such methods, which are clearly those of torture, that oversight and that restriction was eliminated. The specific ban on torture techniques that are outlined in the Geneva Convention, that amendment was was defeated by a similar margin. As the New York Times had made clear, the sweeping legislation meets all the demands of the Bush administration with the support of the Democratic Party, virtually verging upon an explicit repeal of the Geneva Convention. The provisions include authorizing the president to establish military commissions to prosecute anybody taken into custody, to determine punishment, including death, without a trial, without evidence being presented to the accused, without the right of counsel, rules of evidence that permit hearsay evidence and testimony coerced from witnesses, permitting the use of testimony obtained by, quote, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. If the torture took place before December 30th, 2005, it is admissible that that which was obtained as a result of the torture is admissible in military tribunals and can be used against a defendant without disclosure as to its content. That which is extracted by torture of the most, and we're going to describe what that torture is, the most unspeakable torture that makes the Inquisition in the Middle Ages look mild by comparison, because here we have the most fiendish deprivation of all sensory contact, covering of all light, no all sound, use of drugs, total disassociation imposed upon the victim, plus the most unspeakable physical tortures. These are, in fact, now sanctioned. All that which has been extracted through the renditions, through the thousands of people who have disappeared into the secret prisons across the world, across Europe, across Asia, across North Africa, all of that is to be now sanctioned as a legitimate part of the rounding up of people, stripping U.S. courts of any jurisdiction over these detainees, stripping detainees of all their rights, and as I mentioned, even to seek the writ of habeas corpus.
Ralph, we should mention that the right to counsel is jeopardized. What the Military Commissions Act of 2006 states specifically is that a military officer who with the legal standing in a court is to represent a detainee. Every detainee is given counsel. But that counsel is a military officer that is subject to his position, his career in the U.S. military. Now, a detainee can seek private counsel, But that private counsel had better have all security clearances in order to see the evidence, because if the evidence is most likely to be classified information, which will be withheld from the detainee, except in some sanitized, redacted form. But for this counsel to have private counsel, along with that private counsel, you must have also this military counsel. In other words, the Army is always looking over the shoulder of the private counsel. And what we saw with Lynn Stewart is that the new regulations will enable the government to listen in to the meetings between counsel and detainee. Let's look again at how this Military Commissions Act even came to being. We mentioned habeas corpus, and the actual date is 1679 of the original Habeas Corpus Act in Great Britain. On November 13, 2001, shortly after the events of September 11, 2001, the Presidential Military Order was enacted, which gave the President of the United States the power to detain certain non-citizens suspected of connection to, quote, terrorists or terrorism as enemy combatants. And what we had eventually was seizing U.S. citizen Jose Padilla and Salim Ahmed Hamdan. And as U.S. citizen, Hamdan petitioned for a writ of habeas corpus. He challenged the lawfulness of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's plan to try him for alleged war crimes before a military commission that had been convened under special orders issued by the President of the United States, rather than before a, quote, court-martial, which has specific rules of evidence, like you have in a regular U.S. court, in other words, where you cannot bring forward evidence without showing it to the accused, and other legal conventions. So this court-martial is convened under the Unified Code of Military Justice, and this was going to be suspended. This worked its way, Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, up to the Supreme Court, which on June 29, 2006, in a 5-3 ruling, rejected the attempts to strip the courts of jurisdiction over habeas corpus appeals by the detainees at Guantanamo. And what the court said is that Congress had not legislated what would happen in a military commission. And consequently, what Congress did is it went even further in granting President Bush, or the President of the United States, be it Bush or anyone else, the arbitrary right of deciding over the lives of detainees. Ralph.
Article 1, Section 9 of the United States Constitution declares the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended. And then it adds, unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it. So what are we dealing with here? The suspension of habeas corpus, that most elementary right encoded first under Henry II in the 12th century and then memorialized in the Magna Carta, and then brought into British common law in 1689, to be suspended. And what is the rationale for that? That the attacks of September 11th constitute rebellion and an invasion so that all rights can be suspended in the United States. And what is the basis on which the blind Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman was brought to trial? The FBI conspiracy, through its own agents, to plan attacks on the landmarks in New York, as we've mentioned in past programs, the George Washington Bridge, the Lincoln Tunnel, the Holland Tunnel, the Statue of Liberty, etc. The FBI plan, along with the Mossad, to bomb the World Trade Center in 1993, the soliciting of meetings, the providing of the explosives, the organizing of the safe house and the rental van, all done by the intelligence services of the United States and Israel, a matter of documentation, a false flag operation. imputing, indeed, in the trial of the lawyer defending the blind sheikh falsely accused, all of the acts of so-called terror, the bombing of the embassies in Dar es Salaam and Nairobi, the attack on the USS Cole, and, of course, the attacks of September 11, 2001, imputed to Osama bin Laden, when the hands of intelligence are all over these operations. And so when the lawyer, Lynn Stewart, a heroic figure with a lifetime of commitment to defending those targeted by authority, those who have resisted the crimes of authority, those who have defended the rights of the oppressed, Black Liberation Army, Black Panthers, people who have been engaged in speaking out about exploitation and oppression who are then targeted by the state, the attorney who has devoted her life to the defense of democratic rights and the rights of the oppressed, is then folded into the crimes that are being falsely invented and imputed to the victims, crimes that are in fact authored, like the Reichstag fire itself, by the criminal state, by the terror state, by the state of Mortimer Snerd and his satraps, Rumsfeld and Cheney and Democratic Party collaborators. That's what's at stake here, brothers and sisters. The bill's provisions also violate the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution that spells out the requirements of a fair trial. And that amendment to the Constitution was based upon the colonists' experience with the absolutism of the British Crown. That amendment reads, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury where the crime shall, in the district where the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with witnesses against him, to have compulsory processes for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for that defense. That is the Sixth Amendment. And what is it that has occurred in the trial of Lynn Stewart? The right to counsel is abrogated. The counsel who is brought to defend not just the rights of the accused, but the rights of every citizen of this country, because it is the democratic struggles of the American Revolution that enshrined these rights. That's what's at stake here in the persecution of Lynn Stewart. That's what it means to charge her with being a career criminal and of being her. You know what the charges are against Lynn Stewart? That her very person, that her very belief system, that her very life constitutes material support for terrorism. What is the basis of that? The invasion of her home and office by the Gestapo FBI, the seizure of her files, of her articles, newspaper articles and clippings, her books, her readings, her research on the basis of defending the accused over a space of 35 years, all of this randomly seized by this Gestapo-like police, and then picked and parceled amongst themselves and brought into a trial to say, ah, you see, she talks about a struggle in Congo here in 1971. Oh, here's an article about the Nicaraguan Revolution in 1984. Oh, here is an objection to the torture under the School of the Americas in 1973. Career criminal and terrorist. What are we looking at here? In the person of Lynn Stewart, in the destruction of her First Amendment and her Sixth Amendment rights, an all-out attack upon the constitutional protections, and that means targeting everybody in this society, and that is what the Enabling Act, in the face of the Reichstag fire, was designed to achieve. And there is a one-to-one parallel between that Reichstag fire and the Reichstag fire of September 11th, 2001. And there is a one-to-one relationship between the total and arbitrary authority granted the executive figure, the decider. What are we told about these people who are now imposing arbitrary law upon us, as they roll their eyes to heaven, that they are doing this in the name of their benighted God? They are members of the God Squad, these people, these theocrats, as they destroy the gains and the liberties and the rights of every citizen in this society. This is treason at the top. The targeting of Lynn Stewart is treason at the top. The railroading of a defense attorney to prison for 30 years is treason at the top.
We will pause now for a station identification.
Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WVAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York. Enjoy.
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Terror State Targets Lynn Stewart, Part 4, The Relentless Assault on Democratic Rights. We are discussing today, in particular, the Military Commissions Act of 2006 that was passed last week by Congress, by the Senate, and before that by the House. This was passed by the Senate on September 28th. 2006. And in it, it specifies unlawful enemy combatant. Let's look at the definition now codified by Congress. The term unlawful enemy combatant means an individual determined by or under authority of the President or the Secretary of Defense. And this is what we were saying before about the arbitrary power that has now been relegated to the President and the Secretary of Defense. Quote, to the unlawful enemy combatant, as certified by the President or the Secretary of Defense or assigned to a commission that they set up, to be part of or affiliated with a force or organization, including but not limited to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, any international terrorist organization or associated forces engaged in hostilities against the United States or its co-belligerents in violation of the law of war. B, to have committed a hostile act in aid of such force or organization so engaged. Or C, and this note the very vague wording, to have supported hostilities in aid of such a force or organization so engaged. Now, it's important to look at this very vague wording of to have supported hostilities. And these terrorist organizations come and go, as noted before. The African National Congress had been listed as a terrorist organization by the State Department, and now the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine is on this list of terrorist organizations, as are many resistance organizations, movements for national liberation throughout the world.
How do you think Nelson Mandela was put in prison, brothers and sisters? The Central Intelligence Agency targeting the terrorist Nelson Mandela in collaboration with the boss, the secret police of South Africa, tracked him with their overhead spy apparatus of satellite and other communications, monitored Nelson Mandela, found where he could be located, organized his entrapment. In fact, they were planning to shoot him. It's only because of the fortuitous circumstance that witnesses that they could not eliminate at the same time that they detained him instead of killing him. But all the time, the intelligence agencies and the Reagan administration itself had declared him a wanted terrorist to be hunted down. It's from Nelson Mandela to Lynn Stewart. It's anybody who resists the fascist state in preparation that is targeted in this way, brothers and sisters. Those are the stakes. Let me just say this. The head of the National Lawyers Guild, Marjorie Cohen, in an article entitled Rounding Up U.S. Citizens, spelled out exactly what is being put into play here. She writes, the Military Commissions Act of 2006, governing the treatment of detainees, is the culmination of relentless fear-mongering. The bill was adopted with lightning speed, barely anyone noticing that it empowers Bush to declare not just aliens, but specifically U.S. citizens, as unlawful enemy combatants. Anyone who donates money to a charity, she writes, that turns up on a list of Bush's terrorist organization, anyone who speaks out against the government's policies can be declared an unlawful enemy combatant and imprisoned indefinitely. And specifically, that means American citizens. In stripping habeas corpus rights from the detained, she writes, Congress has the constitutional power to suspend habeas corpus only in times of rebellion or invasion, but this has been stripped. And the new bill allows for the complete abandonment of any right to trial, any right to counsel, any right to evidence, any right to escape being disappeared. And as she writes, although more insidious, the law follows in the footsteps of repressive legislation. And she analogizes this to the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, which were designed to stifle dissent against the Federalist Party's political agenda, which included enshrining the banks as the commanding factor in the burgeoning economy of the new republic. The Alien Enemies Act, which provided for the arrest, detention, and deportation of male citizens of any nation at war with the United States. That meant 25,000 French citizens living in the U.S., at the time, there's a whole history of such attempts to dismantle the gains of that democratic revolution of the 18th century. And that is what we are dealing with today. In fact, let's look carefully at what we're discussing here when we talk about an enemies list. Here is the Washington Post, February 15th, 2006. 325,000 names are on a, quote, terrorism list. 325,000 people. The National Counterterrorism Center maintains a central repository of 325,000 names of people who allegedly are, what, aiding terrorism. This list has quadrupled since 2003. And in fact, when we look carefully at the breakdown of this list, it is very obvious that it is only a fraction of the numbers, the actual number of people who have been targeted. There are 26 terrorism-related databases compiled by agencies throughout the, quote, intelligence and law enforcement communities. I love this term, communities. The intelligence community, the death squad community, the torture community, the stripping of fingernails out of hands community, the crushing of testicles community. Civil liberty advocates and privacy experts have stated that the size of the National Council for Terrorism database is so vast, the American Civil Liberties Union and Timothy Sparapani, its legislative counsel, called the numbers shocking beyond belief. We have lists that are having baby lists. They're spawning faster than rabbits, he writes. If we have over 300,000 known so-called terrorists who want to do this country harm, we've got a much bigger problem than deciding which names go on that list. But let's look at that. Let's look at that, brothers and sisters. 250,000 names emerged from the FBI alone. 250,000 of the FBI. 26 other agencies compiling similar lists, the Central Intelligence Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the State Department, unnamed and numberless sub-agencies, the directive calling upon agencies to supply data who are known or suspected to be engaged in contact, constituting an attack or an undermining of the policies of the United States. What does that mean? Example, any individual who writes an article that can be deemed to give material aid to terrorism or moral aid to terrorism qualifies. The 270,000 names that are on the FBI data list, only the tip of the iceberg. 25,000 codes are assembled in relation to this. CIA, DIA, FBI, State Department, and 13 independent agency watch lists. 26 additional classified data networks. In a December 2000 interview on Federal News Radio, it was stated by one of the directors of these agencies that the only place in government and certainly in the intelligence community where all the counterterrorism intelligence comes to comes together is in the National Council Against Terrorism. So they are coordinating a list that dwarfs the 325,000 people that we're describing here. And why is it then that the Kellogg Brown and Root has been handed a vast budget for setting up detention centers across the United States? How come they've been allocated these funds already for the setting up of of detention centers for the roundup of people in the United States? Is this an academic exercise in the face of what we're describing here?
Ralph, it is not an academic exercise. And the Military Commissions Act of 2006 is only one part of what has been taking place. Although it specifies that providing material support for terrorism in Section 24, quote, any person who provides material support or resources knowing or intending that they are to be used in preparation for or in carrying out an act of terrorism as defined in subsequent sections and also as defined in other U.S. codes, who intentionally provides material support or resources to an international terrorist organization engaged in hostilities against the United States, a very vague wording since it's subjective according to the presidential authorities and Department of State, knowing that organization has engaged or engages in terrorism, shall be guilty of the offense of providing material support. But it also goes on to say in the next section, wrongfully aiding the enemy. Any person who in breach of an allegiance or duty to the United States knowingly or intentionally aids an enemy of the United States or its co-belligerents, in other words, referring to people within the military or who are working for the U.S. government. And also further on, conspiracy. Any person who conspires to commit in one of or more substantive offenses triable under this act is also under penalty. But the reason I say this is only one part is that if you go to, on the Internet, Duke Law Civil Liberties Online, which is at www.law.duke.edu, you find an important analysis, increasing the government's ability to prosecute acts that support terrorism, because it describes the implications prior to the Military Commissions Act of 2006 of the U.S. Patriot Act and how it created vague definitions such as punishing harboring terrorists, which had been part of U.S.C. 1324 and 18 U.S.C. 792. And then also in a certain section of the Patriot Act, how it defended telemarketing and Consumer Fraud and Abuse Prevention Act, which had been rules for the Federal Trade Commission, how it extended it to include charitable organizations, and then how it shifted criminalizing behavior to a new timeline for, quote, potential terrorist acts, expanding the definition of the crime of giving material support, so that there was a broad sweep, Duke Law says, in the wide array of behavior. So everything is broadened so that, quote, monetary instruments are that's extended to be cash and financial securities. But most importantly is this section that says, quote, expert advice or assistance, which could mean assisting people in preparing a leaflet or a radio show or videotaping an event. This is the type of actions that are now going to be considered as aiding and abetting, being material support for terrorist activities.
Well, let's be clear. Maya, when you and I were in Palestine on the first anniversary of Sabra and Shatila, and we were engaged in organizing a mass march on Jerusalem on the first anniversary of Sabra and Shatila, involving the trade unions, all of the popular organizations, including the band mayors from Nablus and from Ramallah and Jericho, including international citizens. What happened? We were arrested immediately by the Israelis, and we were declared agents of a terrorist's power.
Of a terrorist organization. That being the Palestine Liberation Organization.
If you say that the oppressed have the right to resist, you are giving material support to terrorism. If you organize in defense of those who are being oppressed, if you call out crimes against humanity in the form of torture, you are aiding and abetting terrorism. If you say that the Palestinian people are the world's soldiers for justice, you are giving material and moral support to so-called terrorist operations.
Ralph, let me interrupt you here, because the Zionist state, the Israeli government, had written actually to a member of British Parliament who had inquired of the Israeli state why we had been deported.
Detained and deported.
And this happened individually, first you and then me. And it was the response of the Israeli state to this British member of parliament.
What is the background to this, Maya?
Right. But, Ralph, let me say here that they had said we were acting as agents of a terrorist organization. It also so happens that at the time in the United States, up until 1988, when the Palestine Liberation Organization changed its charter, that the PLO itself was considered by the United States to be a terrorist organization. And this goes to show you how it has become the fascistization of the state. In other words, resistance to oppression is considered as aiding and abetting terrorism.
Well, of course, what we're actually looking at here, let's be very straightforward about this. This 1% of the population that owns and controls more than 95% of the wealth of the nation, of all that we hold, all of us combined, is a criminal cabal. They wage permanent war in pursuit of exploitation, and they engage through the enforcement arm of the state in massive repression. When the Kennedy execution unfolded, Malcolm said, "You can't have death squads running across the planet and think they're going to stop at your national frontiers. The chickens have come home to roost." Every one of us, brothers and sisters, who struggles in defense of democratic rights, who acts in defense of the oppressed, who opposes the brutal and arbitrary power of an exploitative and rapacious capitalist system, is targeted here. The life of Lynn Stewart is designated by its very presence material aid and support for terrorism. As Marjorie Cohn says, the Military Commissions Act of 2006 provides the basis for the president to round up U.S. citizens, any he determines to have given material support. Kellogg Brown and Root is constructing huge facilities at undisclosed locations to hold tens of thousands of undesirables. And in USA Today, Maya, on September 29th, 2006, Gonzalez, the Attorney General, cautions justices against second-guessing the president in wartime. The Attorney General has declared that federal judges may not substitute their views for the president's judgment. Mortimer Snerd's judgment prevails. The Constitution, as Mortimer Snerd once said, is nothing but a scrap of paper.
Ralph, let's not just individualize it to George Bush, because these are powers that are now encoded. No matter who is president, these are the laws of the United States.
Yes, of course.
And this Duke Law piece that goes into the analysis of the Patriot Act and the analysis of other laws prior to this Military Commissions Act is very important, because it states in here that the criminalization of knowingly providing material support to designated foreign terrorist organizations, is considered, this material support is considered a crime of violence. And as such, someone who is accused, a U.S. citizen included, can be detained before trial without bail. That is, it's up to the court to say whether or not you can have bail in such an instance, because this is considered a crime of violence.
Maya, let's look at this very carefully. Bush advisor says president has legal power to torture children. John Yoo. Who is John Yoo, the professor of law at the University of California? It is John Yoo, along with Alberto Gonzalez, who has prepared all of this legislation for Mr. Bush and his acolytes and his controllers. Well, John Yoo was confronted in December 1st, 2005 in Chicago by professor of law and international human rights scholar Doug Cassell. Doug Cassell, Professor Cassell in Chicago, addressed a question to John Yoo. He asked him, as Deputy Assistant to Attorney General John Ashcroft, I want to ask you, when you are holding, you've been defending interrogation that entails torture, when you are holding someone that you wish to interrogate, can you bring his 10-year-old child before him, his 10-year-old boy, and crush the testicles of that 10-year-old child? John Yoo responded as follows. If the president deems that he has to torture somebody, including the crushing of the testicles of a person's child, there is no law to impede it. No treaty. Cassell, no law by Congress? Is this what you wrote in your August 2002 memo? John Yoo, it depends solely on why the president thinks he needs to do that. Do you register this? John Yoo, who wrote the memo, who crafted the law, who represents the Justice Department, who represents the President of the United States, who represents the Attorney General, is stating it is entirely a matter of why the President decides it necessary to crush the testicles of a 10-year-old child in the presence of his parent. And this in a public forum?
Well, Ralph, what we have now with the Military Commissions Act of 2006 is it's no longer nebulous presidential authority. It is now the law of the land as passed by the U.S. House of Congress.
Maya, let me just follow up on this, please. John Yoo authored the series of legal memos for unlimited presidential powers to order the torture of captive suspects and to declare war anytime, anywhere, and in anyone the president deems a threat.
That's the preemptive action.
Yes. He wrote the book on torture. This is the article that is going to be coming out in the next issue, October 9, 2006, The American Conservative. War by Other Means, an insider's account of the war on terror by John Yoo, Atlantic Monthly Press. In this book, he formalizes what we've been describing here, and which has just been encoded into law by the two capitalist parties falling over each other in their hurry to dismantle the constitutional protections and our democratic rights. A torturer's emancipation proclamation memo is how this conservative newspaper describes it, as the Deputy Assistant Attorney General. He informed the White House in August 2002 it can scorn federal law because the president enjoys total discretion in his exercise as commander-in-chief. There's much to be said more about this. The CIA holds terror suspects in secret prisons across the planet. William Satire's article.
Sapphire.
Excuse me. yes, Satire indeed. Sapphire's article, You Are a Suspect, November 14th, 2002, in which every single one of us your credit cards, your magazine subscriptions, your medical prescriptions, every website you visit, every email you send or receive, every academic grade you receive, every bank deposit you make, every trip you book, every event you attend, all of this into the Defense Department's virtual centralized grand database.
Ralph.
Legalizing torture, targeting the defenders of us all, criminalizing dissent, targeting the lawyers, railroading Lynn Stewart to prison. That's what's at stake in this attack upon Lynn Stewart. It is the prelude to the destruction of our liberties. Mobilizing her defense. Riverside Church, October 15th, brothers and sisters, and at the courthouse on the 16th of October. We'll be continuing next week with the legalizing of torture and the destruction of our rights and the building of a movement of resistance to remove this criminal conspiracy that is at the height of power in the United States.
As Ralph mentioned, Riverside Church on October 15th, that's from 4 to 7 p.m., and Monday, October 16th, is the sentencing hearing for Lynn Stewart, 10 a.m., Federal Courthouse in Manhattan. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Terrorist Day Targets Lynn Stewart, Part 4, The Relentless Assault on Democratic Rights, was recorded Tuesday, October 2nd, 2006. The prior parts of this series, as well as our other programs, are on our website and our program archive at www.takingaim.info. I'd also like to mention that, thanks to Pete Hunter, this is the second Taking Aim program that has been recorded for television and will be on Berkeley Public Access. And if you have a public access station in your area, please contact us for the DVD. And Taking Aim is going onto television as well as on the internet through WBAI and in the greater New York area on WBAI. We'll be with you next week.
And in every community across this country before long, brothers and sisters.
Hi, this is Mark Ruffalo. Wars, lies, torture, theocracy. The Bush regime is on its way to destroying the world. Some feel there's nothing we can do. But thousands are already getting organized in over 130 cities on October 5th. Be a citizen. It'll be fun. Take off work, walk out of school, and march through the streets. On October 5th, the world can't wait. Drive out the Bush regime. WorldCan'tWait.org, 866-973-4463.
What's going on? What's going on? What's going on?
On Wednesday, October 4th at 7 p.m., a distinguished panel will discuss ethics and journalism, the critical issues facing the media today. Speakers are Helen Thomas, Adam Morse, Richard Stengel, Jeff Jarvis, Randall Pinkston, and moderated by Orville.